Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, the listeners of One Pastor's Dogs podcast. Thank you so much for being the loyal listeners and followers, and apologize for not uploading episode. I think in the past few months, I'm very busy with the B20 summit, and fortunately it went successful. And as usual, you know, in December we post a year-end review. Which is a discussion with many of my colleagues. And here with me, I'm so proud and very grateful of having four of the members of Foreign Policy Talks Discussion Club, which is one of the units of Foreign Policy Talks. Let me greet them first and allow me to invite them to introduce themselves as well. So first we have Karina Jo. Hi, Karina. How are you doing?
Hi, Noto. I'm good. Thank you. How are you?
I'm fine. Exciting to discuss with you. But Karina, I think the listener wants to know more about you. So what's your background and where are you based now?
Okay, so my name is Karina Jo. Hello, everyone. I'm a senior scientist working in Gender Institute, University of Oxford. So my latest project was I was the lead scientist in the vaccine development, specifically in the large-scale manufacturing of Oxford AstraZeneca vaccines, and currently I'm working for Ebola vaccines for deployment in Africa. So I'm based in Oxford, United Kingdom.
Wow, that's very interesting, Karina. So Karina is basically a scientist, and she's a vaccine maker, and as you know, that she was one of our guests in the previous episode, and she was very critical to the development of COVID vaccine, yeah?
Yeah.
I think last year or 2 years ago. Thank you so much, Karina, for joining. So let me invite another member of the group, Esther. How about you, Esther?
Doing great, Noto. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Esther. So I'm sure that Indonesian foreign policy enthusiasts know more about you, but for the listeners outside the country, will you be able to introduce yourself?
Yes. So I work with Foreign Policy Community of Indonesia, or FPCI, and we're the largest foreign policy group, not only in the country, but also in Southeast Asia, right? And we focus a lot about foreign policy issues and global affairs. And in that context, I'm leading the Climate Unit Department, which is a task force, if you will, dedicated to advance the net zero by 2050 call in Indonesia. I do have an international relations background. So I combine both my climate advocacy efforts and my foreign policy focus. And I birthed this baby called climate diplomacy. So that's what I've been focusing on and what I hope to share with you all today.
Thank you so much, Esther. So we have someone from health background and a climate background. So we have, I think it's almost perfect. But anyway, let me invite another friend, Jonas. So Jonas, how are you?
I'm pretty good. Thanks for the invitation, Noto. Greetings from cold Brussels here in the winter of 2022.
Wow. Okay, so what's your role now, Jonas?
Well, I work in Brussels with a German political foundation. We are basically working on different political issues, but my main focus is at the moment, obviously, the democracy development here in Europe, and as well also the security situation. And what we're basically doing, we're having offices all around the world, around 200. And we are basically working together with our guests and potential delegations in these countries to enforce and increase basically the relations with the European Union and make them understand also better this big bureaucratic monster here in Brussels.
Mm, very, very interesting. It sounds like a very important job, Jonas. And thank you so much for brought up winter in 2022. I think we want to discuss about what happened now in Europe during this winter time. And anyway, let me invite the last person in a group who's going to be joining us in this conversation. CK, you can clarify what's your real name, but I call you CK as always. But anyway, how are you, CK?
I'm good. Thanks, Noto. Thank you very much for the invitation. My name is Ha Chae-kyun, and you know, I just go by CK. I'm originally from Korea, and I'm a doctoral candidate at the University of Cambridge studying the international relations of Asia-Pacific, or nowadays it's called the Indo-Pacific. So I'm interested in studying the foreign policies and security policies of the countries in this region, including Korea, Japan, Australia, ASEAN, and so forth. So yeah. Thank you for the invitation again.
Right, thank you, CK. And so we have a complete, a group of expert, young expert, and then happy to discuss about what happened in 2022 with all of you. But let me start with one interesting question for me. It's if you can describe our world in 2022 in one word, what will it be? And feel free to share what's the reason behind your answer. And I think I'll start with Esther, because, you know, Esther, in 2021, I remember that one thing that most people are afraid of is about climate change in 2022. So do you, in your opinion, how do you define or how do you describe our world in 2022 in one word?
When I was considering this question, one word came to mind, divided, but I decided not to go forward with that because, you know, for reasons that we can talk about later, the G20 summit has been able and successful to bridge differences. So if I were to put it in one word, I'll instead go with the word distress. Mm. And this is because I observe that we are continuously faced with new multifaceted and multi-dimensional challenges. So it's one stress over the other, first the pandemic, and then the upcoming economic recession, then Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And then we know that the climate crisis is not getting solved. So it's just a tumultuous of challenges and crisis. And I don't necessarily see any beacon yet. There's no light at the end of the tunnel just yet at the end of this 2022. So I would summarize it as a very distressed world.
Wow, a very distressed world. And so you think that 2022, that people are pessimistic and feel that it's going to be more polarized, but it's not seen from what happened in this year. That's what you see. That's why you change your word from divided into distress.
Yeah, I think we ran out of energy, Noto. All throughout the year, there has been a lot of summits, conferences, world leaders gathering, but none of it really solved anything, right? We put a lot of hope on the G7 summit, mobilizing the food crisis package, and then, that did not really end well in the sense that not a lot of implementation. And then the G20 also was largely focused on Russia's invasion of Ukraine and how to maintain the G20 grouping as a whole, although we do get some sideline bilaterals outcomes out of it. And then COP27 and Sharm el-Sheikh, loss and damage, yes, and I'll talk about this later on, but I think we are running out of energy, we're running out of fuel, and there needs to be one good thing that happened early on next year to make us going, to keep us going.
Wow, interesting, Esther. Let me continue with Karina. I'm interested to hear from you as a scientist. So how do you describe our world in one word, Aina?
I think for the 2021, I describe it as hope. But 2022, I will describe it in one word as recovery. I mean, we're still recovering from pandemic from the global health perspective sides. I think it's a short answer, but we're still recovering. And then it's quite a slow recovery for our world today.
Slow recovery. So that's how you define it, yeah? Okay.
Yeah.
So interested to follow up with you on how we can make a very quick recovery, quick and rapid recovery. That's what I mean. But anyway, thank you so much, Karina. Let me proceed with Jonas. So Jonas, from someone based in Europe, and of course, you know what happened in the region in the past few months. So how do you define a world in one word?
I think I would go for uncertainty. I think it's mostly because obviously we've seen like the security situation here in Europe deteriorating with the war in Ukraine. But I think also if we look at around the world, you see that governments authoritarian or democratic are like stumbling. So you see, for example, also in Iran, the revolutions coming up. And I think for me, it's also that, of course, there's a little bit more hope than that Esther sees it. I think that especially in the EU, the feeling is that it brought us together more. So like that there's a more united position towards authoritarian systems, towards Russia becoming more independent as a global geopolitical actor. And I think that was a really good development in general, that you see, for example, that Europe can actually be productive and can manage things. And it's not just this big block, which has different opinions and only meets at the lowest common denominator. So for me, it's more like that the world has become less predictable because also you don't know what's happening with Russia. You don't know what's happening with China. You don't know what's happening in Iran in the future. And I think that's like an important point to make. And looking forward to discuss this as well with you, especially from a position, obviously, also from Germany, which was heavily changing its course, especially in the security situation that we have now.
Wow, interesting. So uncertainty is your word. Yeah. All right. So let me continue with CK. So CK, as someone who is based in South Korea and a South Korean living in a dynamic region of East Asia. So how do you describe our world in one word?
So yeah, I was actually thinking of two words instead of one. And I tried to make it into one, but in the end, I came up with the change and continuity. So one that we saw a number of changes, especially in domestic politics for many countries in this part of the world, in the Indo-Pacific. We saw leadership changes in Australia, Korea, the Philippines, as well as the recent, not a change, but we saw that the United States also recently held the midterm elections, which is heavily involved with the Indo-Pacific region, the United States. And also, as someone studying, we also had the recent elections in Malaysia. So as someone studying in the UK, we also saw a series of leadership change in the UK as well. So there's been a lot of political changes happening in this world. Yet, despite so many changes, from the perspectives of the development of the Indo-Pacific region, the region has been seeing more engagement with this Indo-Pacific narrative and emphasis on this part of the world. So I think despite so many changes happening in different parts of the world, we see a continuity of this focus on the Indo-Pacific region. So that would be my take.
Oh, very interesting. Change and continuity, right? So I think it's important to find a balance of both of them. But anyway, thank you so much for these four words. I'm sure the listeners are now writing down these words and, they think further whether, oh, I think that's a good word for them to explore further. But anyway, let me continue with Esther. So Esther, you discussed about, there are a lot of things that happened in this year, and actually, climate change or energy transition specifically in the G20 has been one of the main focus. Have you seen any significant breakthroughs from all of the commitments or, documents, things that agreed by these leaders in this year in terms of climate change efforts?
Thanks for the question, Otto. One good thing perhaps that came out of this year is the fact that middle powers and developing countries are in the limelight. So countries like Indonesia, like Brazil, like India, including some other developing nations, are taking charge in drafting the global solutions, and we are seeing outcomes of that. The reason why I say this is two. In the context, firstly, on COP27, we have seen that now the parties have agreed to establish what we call a loss and damage fund. So yes. Loss and damage fund means that for those countries who are already experiencing the climate crisis, they will be able to get financing to help them with adapting to those impacts. For an example, we can think of Pakistan, whose floodings this year have impacted 30 million people. So loss and damage funding will be able to help, say, Pakistan to deal with that. Or countries like Maldives, who are already spending 50% of their national budget to adjust with the rising sea levels. So this is what the loss and damage funding will do. However, the downside of that is we still do not know yet who will be financing this financing facility and which countries are eligible to get funding from it. But at least now there's some good thing coming out of the COP27 for developing countries, because again, this relates to the wider context of climate justice, the global north and global south, the historical footprint of industrialization from the West are now the ones that are accelerating the climate crisis, but those who are impacted most are developing nations like Pakistan. So that's one good thing coming out of COP27. And then secondly, on the G20, this is the first, not necessarily the first time, but as compared to last year's G20 held in Italy, the commitment to climate action and to keeping a 1.5 degree world at this year's G20 hosted by Indonesia is much stronger. And honestly, this gave the COP27, which, you know, both conferences are happening at the same time, this gave the COP27 the political impetus and political energy needed to push through for momentum for greater outcomes. So in the G20 text that we have in Indonesia, there's commitment to protect the planet and keep a 1.5 degree world, which is a global temperature rise that is safe for us to have. And then there's also language on focusing on ramping up financing on adaptation. So, you know, financing to adapt to the new world where climate crisis is already here. So the G20 and COP27 go hand in hand, and G20 has done its homework to push COP27 to do more. So I would stop there and we can take this further later.
Right. So are you saying that this significant work is coming from this two multilateral meeting is actually providing us a positive tone for our climate change efforts? Costa.
Positive on the climate justice front. So all these years, right, developing nations have been saying to developed countries, give us the money because you're the one who caused this and now we're dealing with the consequences. So having the loss and damage funding helped with at least one aspect of it, right, which is to help with reparations should, for example, Indonesia be thrown off by a super large flooding or, you know, extreme heat and waves, something like that. But what I'm also observing is that the actual key to solving the climate crisis, which is mitigation efforts, rapidly reducing greenhouse gas emissions, is now thrown off the grid because all the attention is on loss and damage, on climate justice. So a lot of countries are not, COP27 specifically, are disappointing us with the commitment to mitigation or to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. In fact, there's no progressively significant language or commitment since last year's COP26 on mitigation efforts.
Very clear. I think Jonas is very much triggered when listening to you, right? I mean, he's coming from a developed nation. Anyway, Jonas, let me continue with you. So people are, you know, like moving their eyes to Europe since the invasion of Russia to Ukraine happened in early 2022. And of course, we all observe what happened since then with all of the, you know, like the economic and political consequences given to this war. But Jonas, what do you want to share about the state of European security today? How is the feeling of European now on the chance of having peace in this situation?
Yeah, thanks a lot for the question, Noto. I would say that for sure the European security architecture is changing. And I think that also has to do, obviously, with the war in Ukraine, because if you look at it from a different angle, or especially from a German angle, that you had basically a security order with Russia that was completely shaping the EU-Russia relationship for the last 30 years. And I think what happened now is that, obviously, the European states are seeing Russia not only as the biggest threat to peace and stability in Europe. Like a couple of days ago, the European Parliament and the MPs officially declared Russia as a state sponsor of terrorism. But that you also see, for example, that Germany, where I'm unfortunately from, no, just kidding, where Germany is playing an important role because they have been the weakest spot. They have been the main target of disinformation campaigns from Moscow. They have been economically and energy dependent on Russia for the last 30 years as well. So they were also obviously involved with the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline. So I think that's changing. And I think with that, what you can see also here in Europe is that the European Union is coming closer together, but that it's also changing more its priorities for the next years to come, because we don't know yet how long the war will drag on, that also they're spending more money and GDP on security in general. So, and I think there's also like new alliances building. So you can see definitely the Eastern Bloc with Poland, Latvia, with Estonia, with Lithuania, we're dedicating a lot of their GDP on security in the upcoming years, especially Estonia, who recently called for a 3% increase of their national GDP to security. And I think that's also what they're discussing at NATO at the moment. Secretary General Stoltenberg also said that we need to spend more on that. And I think it's kind of like curious also, because if you look over the years, the US always demanded Europe to be more strategically autonomous and to actually invest more money into their security systems. And it really needed, if you want to say it in like a bad tone, that war to actually come together to show that Europe has to be a geopolitical actor and can be a geopolitical actor, and that they also like obviously need to come together to get something out of their common foreign and security policy. And I think we're on a good path there. It's definitely showing unity this year, but it also depends on what is happening in the future. And I think that's why I referred earlier to uncertainty, where I don't know if that's gonna stay like this or if there's gonna be a rift with elections coming up in Europe and the sponsors of disinformation campaigns that lead to more polarized and populist governments, as we could see this year also, for example, in Italy or in the presidential elections in France, where Le Pen also was getting like a lot of votes. So I think in total, we can definitely say that the security situation is changing in Europe. And I think it could be declared also for the better.
Right. Jonas, I think, you know, in the UN, a resolution that condemned Russian action has been released. And there's so many things that also agreed by many leaders regionally, bilaterally, or multilaterally to fight against this invasion of Russia to Ukraine. But in your view, what's the strongest action that has been done this year and substantially helped to end the Russian invasion to Ukraine?
I think it was, of course, the sanction packages. I think we're now at 8 sanction packages and they're calling for a 9th one. But I think also showing the Russian leadership in Moscow that what they considered by history, their traditional sphere of influence, that the EU's weaknesses and contradictions are actually not that important as the unity that they can bring to the table when it comes to their foreign policy, their soft power, but also how they basically use their military power to prevent a further loss of influence in Ukraine. And I think this also showed like dedication to the countries that are on the doorstep of Russia. So for example, if you look to Georgia, if you look to Moldova, if you look to, for example, also Poland, I would say that Russia understands this message and that Europe also has to build their own foreign and security policy in the future. Because I mean, if you look back, there were many mistakes in the position towards Russia or vis-a-vis Russia. And I think that Europe must become more proactively active also in the region, and especially in the Eastern neighborhood, and integrate them and offer them a clear perspective, which they did with Ukraine, but it's not only Ukraine in that region. And what I also think in general will be important for, if you look to Russia policy, is to also like call the actors out in the European Union that have been heavily influenced by that. If it's Italy, if it's Austria, if it's Germany, and to find a common position that obviously shows a clear message to Russia that Europe is united and that we also are becoming a geopolitical actor on our own.
That's very interesting, Jonas. And I will come back with you on the energy security. I know there's a lot of dynamics in this topic. And let me proceed with Karina. So Karina, you said in 2022 is actually a year of slow recovery. So I'm interested to know from you, what are the biggest lessons learned from the pandemic recovery this year? I think it's no longer about, to find a cure for our COVID pandemic, right? So how do you define as a scientist of a recovery? And what's your expectations to the future health actually in the next few years?
I think not to find the cure, but I still think that the problem is not over yet. So I said it this in the last podcast, and I will still say it again. So the biggest lesson learned is we are still not ready for any pandemic, even from the last one and maybe for the future one. And as a controversial ideas, I said we are actually quite lucky. Corona is the virus that goes viral, and then we got the pandemic from corona because the immunological pathway of corona is quite simple, and it's quite similar from the last virus. If we have some kind of other unknown virus as a virus in the pandemic time, I think today we will still be in the lockdown.
Wow. And,
yeah.
How much likely that we will have the unknown virus? Given to a very rapid technological advancements this decades, right? So how do you see that? Is this still a big chance for us to face another pandemic with more dangerous virus?
Yeah, of course. There's always a chance of some kind of unknown virus will mutate from animals to humans. If that virus is more complex in the immunological pathway sense, and we have no information about it, then we'll be in a very big trouble. And then what's another lesson learned from the last pandemic is I think people has a short memory. And then nowadays people take slightly of the COVID and they don't want to go for the booster anymore. But it's quite important, even though now the new variants of the COVID is quite, you call it light symptoms. When you got the COVID, but the post-COVID symptom is similar to the previous variant. So it's still cause a burden in NHS and the healthcare system.
Okay, I have a short memory, but fortunately I got booster. Esther, have you got booster for yourself?
Of course I have.
Wow, that's nice.
I want to end the pandemic as soon as we could.
Okay, nice. I don't want to ask Jonas and CK. I'm afraid they haven't got any boosters. But anyway, so Karina, people are talking about China's zero COVID policy in the midst of many countries that try to move on from this COVID, right? Including Indonesia. I mean, we're still using masks. I mean, and the leaders are still showing to the public on how much important to follow the COVID guidance. But how do you see this China's zero COVID policy? Is it something that is wise to be implemented in a large country like China?
Obviously, it's no. I mean, if you talk to any virologist or scientist around the world, you will say that this zero COVID policy is impossible, right? How can you contain this, reduce the like COVID virus that is been everywhere in the world, in the countries such as China, which is very large, and then reduce the number of the COVID positive people into zero? No, I don't think it's possible at all. I think what they should have learned is to live with the current condition, which is to live together with the virus. And then what make it impossible is now, I mean, from the last 2021 and 2020, now we don't have a vaccine that is giving 100% efficacy. So I think going down to zero is impossible.
So what's the highest number? Is it 97, 90, 99?
It's the highest number of the vaccine that I think they measured around 95%, but it's for the previous variant, which is the alpha variant. And then now the coronavirus keep mutating into a new variant, and then of course the efficacy will go down. I think around 60 to 70% now, and then a lot of big pharma is trying to make the new variant vaccines, but the rate of virus mutation is much faster than the rate of those big pharma trying to deploy the new vaccine.
Okay.
So we cannot chase after the mutations. What we need to do is to put more research into this making of the vaccines to predict what kind of mutation is in the future. But at the moment, the government doesn't put any effort, so they think the pandemic has passed. And then they were really worried during the pandemic and then tried to put a lot of funding into this research. But after I don't think the pandemic has passed, but after 2021, now it's 2022, they forgot what is the pandemic is like, and they now cutting the funding into the research, which is in opposite direction that I was hoping. And yeah, I don't think we will be prepared for the next pandemic.
Wow, that's a very strong statement. So we are not ready for the future pandemic. So
no, not at all.
At all, okay. We haven't learned the lesson. I think I would like to move on, Karina. I will get back to you on that. But I will invite CK. So CK, you talk much about changes and continuities, right, in this world. And interestingly, that Indo-Pacific has become more interesting to follow, right? More countries are now having Indo-Pacific strategy. I just talked to a friend from Canada, so they are now having, a strategy to Indo-Pacific region. But I think I would like to explore first about the changing leadership, CK. How do you see this, changing leadership in 2022? Is it something that provide us a fresh air of geopolitics, or is it something that make us worrying because it's becoming more uncertain, like Jonah said?
So my take for the series of leadership changes we saw, especially in the Indo-Pacific region, is rather, despite the changes, we definitely see a continuity. And as you mentioned, Canada also announced its own Indo-Pacific policy. So the emphasis on global politics on the Indo-Pacific region just continues to grow. And we saw Australia earlier this year had its own leadership change to a Labour government. But as soon as the leaders of this new government took office, they went on the number of trips to this part of the world, to Japan and to Indonesia and to the Indo-Pacific region immediately after taking office. And we, despite this political turnover, we saw a continued emphasis to this region from Australia. Of course, Australia, being in this part of the world, has always had a keen interest in this region, but we've seen this continuity despite this political change. Likewise, in South Korea, President Yoon Suk-yeol took office from May and has also recently launched Korea's Indo-Pacific strategy during the ASEAN RRK summit in Cambodia as well. Korea, over the past 5 years under President Moon Jae-in, we elevated our ties with Southeast Asia and India through the New Southern Policy, but there hadn't been an Indo-Pacific narrative to this NSP. But with President Yoon recently announcing Korea's Indo-Pacific strategy, especially in the ASEAN RRK summit, shows how, in a sense, President Moon Jae-in's New Southern Policy, the policy track, is going to be strengthened with President Yoon's Indo-Pacific strategy as well. And also, we mentioned about Canada, but we saw, in a sense, a rather unusual series of leadership changes in the UK, from Boris Johnson to Liz Truss, and then again to Rishi Sunak. But yet, the UK's Indo-Pacific tilt, which was announced last year in 2021, is likely to continue. And perhaps this could be even more favorably received from the region, from the Indo-Pacific region, as the new Prime Minister, Sunak, is also an Asian descent as well. And as you mentioned, we still see a continued emphasis on the Indo-Pacific, the Indo-Pacific strategies from a number of European countries, and especially now that Canada is also joining on board, shows how the significance of the Indo-Pacific region just continues to grow.
Right. So given to a lot of interests of countries in the region to define their own Indo-Pacific strategy, how do you see the things that the countries in the region themselves need to do in anticipating a lot of views about how the Indo-Pacific region should move forward? I mean, you know, like last time we only debate about, okay, which one that we need to follow? Is it the US, Japan, and finally ASEAN, for example, Southeast Asia has its own Indo-Pacific views to the AOIP. And now looking at this, you know, new Indo-Pacific policy, do you think it's becoming more confused for countries in the region to face?
I think rather, as you mentioned, the narrative of this Indo-Pacific did become bigger with this rising geopolitical rivalry between China and the United States. But what's more promising these days, I think, is that the regional stakeholders, the countries in the region, are actually taking more proactive roles to make a greater, in a sense, like architecture of this region. So I think, for example, in a sense, in the recent couple of months, we saw a series of important meetings held in, you know, this part of the world. So Cambodia hosted the ASEAN summit and the relating meetings. And soon after, Indonesia also hosted G20, and Thailand also hosted APEC summit as well. So this Indo-Pacific dynamics wasn't only driven by the US-China rivalry, but we now see a greater role being played by other smaller countries in the region, ASEAN countries, as well as countries like Korea, Australia, Japan, continuing to be involved in these multilateral tracks that are happening in this part of the world.
That's very interesting, CK. I remember when I attended the conference on Indonesian foreign policy, which is organized by a colleague here, Esther. One of the discussion is that, you know, it's not only US and China that has the right, that have the rights to define Indo-Pacific region, right? It's more countries that have their own voices to say on how Indo-Pacific should be in the future. So I think it's similar to what you have just said, CK. I'd like to follow up with one thing. Yesterday I read the result of a meeting between President Xi and President Biden in Bali. And it's quite surprising to me, as the tone that is given by these two leaders are quite positive to each other. You know, a lot of things happened in the past few years between these two superpower, but surprisingly, they're quite, how to say, you know, they're trying to find a common ground, and they don't want to. For example, China, it says that they don't want actually to displace the U.S. In this current world order. I'm curious to know what's your take on the latest development of the U.S.-China relation, if I may. And maybe I'd like to start with Esther, if I can ask you about this.
Yes, sure. I just have to say that all of my colleagues' contributions in this conversation so much has reminded me, firstly, that given the multitudes of challenges and crises that we're facing now, unfortunately, the span of attention that we are receiving has been largely channeled towards the US-China rivalry. Of course, it's a very important dynamics in this 21st century, but we need to be able to bridge, navigate, and cope with these differences to solve our common agenda. I see this because there has been increasingly geopoliticization of common agenda or shared agenda. And this is why I love your question so much, Noto. During the Bali summit, when President Xi and President Biden met, it is not only that they met for the first time in 3 years since Biden assumed office, it is also officially resuming dialogues on multilateral, on various aspects of US and China potential cooperation that has been curtailed or has been put to a stop due to Speaker Pelosi's visit in Taiwan. And let me backtrack a little bit by saying that when the US and China stopped their cooperation dialogue in Taiwan, the rest of us suffers because cooperation between the two countries is so critical to achieving our common agenda. For example, after the visit to Taiwan, the US and China stopped working on climate cooperation. But again, in a world where climate change is a universal issue, you cannot solve this problem without having the top two carbon emitters in the world, which is both US and China, being on the same table negotiating, right? So it's so monumental that the Biden administration and then the Xi administration could finally meet in Bali and resume those dialogues. And again, this relates back to the fact that Indonesia has done superbly well in managing differences and providing a platform for all of these world leaders to put differences aside and get back on track on what we're supposed to be doing. That said, I think that within the next decade, we will still be talking about US and China, and we will still be worrying over whether or not US and China will go to war, whether that's an actual all-out war or like a soft diplomacy kind of war. We don't know yet. I think the world is already leading towards that. But it's also important, is becoming more important that at least dialogues between the two countries remain open, because when they don't talk to one another, the rest of the world suffers. Just like, for example, and I know this is very multidimensional and layered, complex challenge when we think about Russia and Ukraine, which, you know, a lot of people said that we need to isolate Russia. And I so 100% agree with that statement. But when you think about it in a global scale level on our common agenda, shared agenda, like the climate crisis, certainly a net zero world cannot be achieved without Russia also being on the table and us talking and engaging with them to find a solution.
That's very interesting, Esther. I think it gives us a strong message that even in the midst of a lot of challenges that we are facing now, dialogue and cooperation is still the most important thing that we should have, right, in this world. Anyway, Jonas, what do you say? Is this meeting provide you a little hope of certainty?
Nah, for sure. I mean, I still have high hopes for the future, I would say. But I think also that we need to be more like understandable also that the world is changing and that it has also been. So I'm agreeing here definitely on the point with CK. Because the thing is, I think what we also did over the last couple of years was kind of like accepting the world as it is, and we're like, oh, that's actually fine. That's actually good how it is. And we didn't plan in that it doesn't have to be all the time like that. So I think for me in Europe, it's also like, when we're talking about energy security and when we're talking about the effects of the crisis here in Europe, I think it also has the positive effect, for example, that finally European leaders have to sit down and work on reforms and investment, for example, in the framework of the 2020 European Green Deal. So agreeing with Esther there that, for example, Europe finally has to sit down and better strategize how to make the EU climate neutral by 2050, so that you don't have the problem with energy security as you have it right now, and that you're actually implementing also partnerships with other countries and not being completely reliant on one country as they have been energy and economically on Russia for the last years. And therefore, I think it's also interesting to see how all these topics that we are discussing here today are intersecting, because I think, for example, that the EU climate neutrality and the energy security are also a highly, of course, economic development and security project. And I think that this is now seen better by leaders. And I hope that that also helps to that of course we need compromise, but that we also like think for ourselves in Europe. And as we like to say, don't go out with just the blue eyes and believe everything, but that you actually strategize for yourself and also think for the European Union as a as an actor on their own, because then they're also, I think, seen and accepted better by other countries and other states.
Wow, thank you so much, Jonas. I think for our listeners that are now still studying international relations, a single war that happened in Ukraine provide us an understanding that all of them are very intersecting, right? I mean, politics and economy. You see that after a single war in Ukraine, we are now finding alternatives to find solution for our human security, for our food security, energy security, not only in Germany, actually, or not only in Europe, and also financial security. Health security is still at the top of our conversation. So you see that's a lot of dimension have been, you know, think carefully because of a single war. That's something that, you know, make, I think, international relation becoming more interesting also this year. I'd like to ask Karina. Karina, you said that we are not ready for future pandemic. So how do you see the role of US and China if they can collaborate, if they can sit together and find the best solution for our future health? How do you see that? Will it be very much important to health sector?
Of course, it will be a benefit for all of the countries if they can work together and then solve this future problem. But what we see and what we learn from time to time, right? When what was pledged in the meeting and what was actually put into action is quite different. So, and they can agree on something at this time, but when the pandemic happens or any unfortunate events happens, and they will try to take care of their own self-interest first. So when the pandemic happened, each country is trying to save their own country first, and then of course they will put other countries in less priority than their own country. So. And we will need to see and observe what we've actually put into action.
Right. I understand that very well. I mean, a lot of clauses, points have been agreed and signed from a lot of meetings this year, but the most important thing to make it into action, right, Karina?
Yep.
And do you think that the investment to global health has been shown by the countries who are now actually in the top of world order? Let's say China, you know, like US and European countries. Is it enough investment coming from them?
I think I can only comment what's happening in UK because I spend most of the time here at the moment. So during the pandemic, UK has built FIMIC, which is the Vaccine Manufacturing and Innovation Center, for close to around £215 million. And the center was meant to tackle the next pandemic. So it's meant to develop, design, manufacture, and distribute the vaccines, at least to UK, maybe to European world. And now the pandemic is quote is over, so I don't share the same opinion, and now they don't see the value for it for the government anymore, so now they sell it to the private company. So they're actually doing the opposite that we scientists expect. So you know, when the government relies on the big pharma for its vaccine distribution, so one thing comes into our mind that I think, of course, Big Pharma will put more importance on the profit rather than the equity of vaccine distribution. So I think it's going backwards, at least for UK in this regards. And then there's another example that Oxford as the university is trying to, of course, contribute to the future pandemic resolutions. We are trying to create the pandemic science centers. And then the UK government pledged to give half of the funding to build the center if Oxford can find half of the funding. So we go by half-half. So at the moment, Oxford has put in the money as the half for the center, but the government has yet to put another half.
Mm.
So, yeah, I mean, you can, the country can come together or say something in the beginning, but when it comes to realization, I still have to see the evidence. So I'm quite a skeptic on this. Yeah, I'm a scientist, so I made all the conclusion based on evidence or results of experiments. So
absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think it's certainly less and less resources in developing nations, right? And I think it's still very much important for our leaders to observe and to take action from that. So join us, Esther, next time when you meet them. Maybe you can share the message of kinda to them.
Unfortunately, everything is politicized. I mean, I have a lot of complaints during the vaccine discussion during the pandemic, but I will maybe talk in another time about how messy is this whole vaccine equity things. But yeah.
Wow. Yes, we definitely have a time for that. And next time, Akaina. And let me invite CK. I think, CK, you haven't talked about this, right? The US and China. Latest development. So how do you see?
Yes. So I think I'll start with, I agree with Esther that this US-China rivalry is a long-term game. We'll continue to see this 10 years later down the track. And I wouldn't compare it to the Cold War, but this would definitely be a long race between the two countries. And we saw that Xi Jinping has recently consolidated his leadership yet again at the 20th National Congress of the Chinese Communist Party. And United States, it doesn't matter about the elections the US has, the US's position on the US-China rivalry is bipartisan. So whether it's a Republican government or Democratic government, the US will have a bipartisan position on this. So it's going to be a long game. And there are potential, you know, strategic flashpoints that could be problematic as well. The South China Sea, Taiwan Strait, and as we recently witnessed, the development of North Korea's nuclear capability. And China is a direct or at least a key stakeholder to all of these issues. And US also has many friends and allies in this region who are concerned about these problems. Having said that, I'm not too pessimistic. Of course, a closer dialogue between the great powers is definitely desirable, but also at the same time, the US, we need to consider that this is not just about the great power rivalry. The US has, you know, many able partners in this part of the world who are very capable of understanding and dealing with China as well. So I think that would be my take on the great power rivalry.
And don't forget, CK, that Trump is returning, right, back to the competition, to the election in the US. So it's going to be giving us a different story of the US-China rivalry. But let me have this last 4 minutes to invite each of you to provide your closing message. Maybe give see this as a message to all of our listeners. You have different words to start in the beginning. Uncertainty, which just sounds very pessimistic, change and continuity, which is trying to find a balance between both of them, and so on and so forth. Distress, right? So what's your message to our listeners after seeing a lot of things happening in 2022? So let me start with Jonas. Jonas, are you ready with this? So 1 minute.
What I'm hoping to see also in 2023 is that hopefully the world settles a little bit, but what I'm hoping actually, and especially working here in Brussels on democracy, I'm obviously hoping that for example the revolution in Iran brings back the rights for the Iranian courageous women, I'm hoping for the Ukraine war, obviously, that it turns out to end. I mean, these are all really positive messages, I know, and we never know if it really happens. But my take for next year would be also kind of like the frame or the sentence out with the old dependence, in with the new. That also, like, Europe is diversifying their relationships. We're, for example, as you said earlier, with energy security, we're diversifying our partners. So we are now having deals in place with Norway, with the Middle East, with Azerbaijan. So I think also that our, like, focus area in this field, of course, shifts a little bit to a different global world region. And as CK said earlier, I think the Indo-Pacific will gain massively in importance, not only by the strategies, but also if you see Europe's position towards China. So I think it's going to be for sure super interesting. And I think that the relationship between Europe and Asia is going to play a vital role in the years to come.
Thank you so much, Jonas. Karina, how about you?
I think I'm a scientist. I just give a short message to people that, pandemic is real, and that it's handled quite badly before. And I hope people still have a big trust in vaccines, because we do develop the vaccines, and then we follow all of the steps for developing the vaccines, and we always guarantee the highest standard when we release any products into humans. And then please use the vaccines, so we can just end this whole pandemic together.
Please use vaccine. Thank you so much, Karina. CK, what do you think?
Yeah, as we witnessed over the past year, the developments around the Pacific region continues to grow despite many political changes we had in the region. As Jonas mentioned, there will be more dynamic developments with many countries introducing their Indo-Pacific strategies as well. So this is definitely the place you want to keep your eye on in the years to come as well.
Thank you so much, CK. And I think for students and also for researchers who are listening to this podcast, it's very important to follow the dynamics, right, CK? Because it's coming from many places, right? It can be coming from North Korea. We're still having Iran, right? Competing with, I mean, not competing, it's having trouble with a lot of countries in the region, and so on and so forth. Let me close with Esther. Esther, what do you say?
Thanks, Noto. And if I may give a message to the listeners, who I assume are people who care about the global issues, right? I hope that you won't be disengaged in this world that is very distressed. I understand there's a lot of bad news going on, and it's easy to just instead be on Instagram, be on TikTok, take your minds off things. But this is a very deciding moment in history with everything that's going on. So being engaged, being informed is good citizenship. Protect a democracy, especially with countries that are having huge elections next year or the year after. Elect good leaders and hold your leaders accountable. I'm specifically talking to my Indonesian peers. Next year is going to be an election year, so make sure that we elect a good leader that will protect the planet, protect Indonesia, and protect freedom. We see that what's happening in Brazil with the election victory of Lula have at least produce positive outcomes. He has committed to protect forests, and then has also committed to stop gas and fossil fuels exploration. So elect good leaders and hold them accountable. And lastly, I just want everybody to take a moment to consider what kind of individual advocacy can you do for the planet, because eventually this will be the planet that you inherit down the line. And if it's not a good planet, then it's going to be on our own merit. And it's because of our own inaction that we are not living in a good planet and a green planet later down the line. Thanks, Noto.
Thank you so much. I'm very happy to spend the past 1 hour with all of you. Karina, Joe, Jonas, Nitch, CK, Esther, Tamara, thank you so much once again for your time, for your input, for your insight, for your views about the world in 2022, and some, of course, about what's going to be happening in 2023. Thank you so much, guys. And I hope that conversation is going to be useful for many, especially to understand the global issues wisely. Of course, if you read the news, don't just trust them automatically. You need to be, critical. You need to listen a lot of perspectives. So this episode is actually trying to give you more perspectives. Thank you so much. And I hope to see you again in 2023. And we will be happy to invite you again for a year-end review in 2023. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Noto.
Thanks, Karina. Thank you. Jonas and CK.